investments to keep this amazing service alive. Find us at www.joesmill.org or Joe's Mill on Facebook for more information on borrowing instruments or contributing to Joe's Mill.
It's 11 p.m. here in the city, and I hope you are ready to be gay and do crime with Mark Terra and Rainbow Country right here, right now on CFRC.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful, listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
As a performer, every performer pretty much has the same checklist of things that they want to accomplish. It's perform on the Thanksgiving Day parade, perform at the Tonys, be on an original cast album.
Today on Rainbow Country, plus paying tribute to a Canadian music icon. That and more next. So stay right here on Rainbow.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Terra.
Well, hello, and welcome to Rainbow, to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community. Voice. I'm your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Terra. Well, thanks to you tuning in, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into an award-winning, nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a nutcast. So, today, reality TV with Broadway performer, reality TV personality, husband. We'll chat about life as a Broadway performer, his time on reality TV on Big Brother. We'll get a glimpse into the life of too much more. In hour two, music from independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. First up, 24th, 2026, we lost a Canadian music icon, Grammy award-winning musician, singer Thomas, probably best iconic rock group, Blood, Sweat and Tears, a group that has sold well over 60 million albums worldwide. In 2019, I had the pleasure of chatting with David Clayton Thomas about his early days in the music and Sweat and Tears, as well as being one of the headliners at Woodstock. Before we get into that interview, I want to give a special shout out to Dustin Boulder from Facebook, who suggested I rebroadcast my David Clayton Thomas. Well, Dustin Boulder, good memory and great call. Mr. David Clayton Thomas, how are you?
I'm fine, Mark. And yourself?
I am doing well. It is, I have to say, it is an honor. It's a privilege to talk with you. So, 1964, the Fabulous Shays, Out of the Sunshine, Walk That Way. Singles, were they not?
In an era where singles didn't mean a whole lot, because there was no real record industry in Canada, so I'm in Canada and still working before I decided to hitchhike down to the States.
Hey.
Yeah.
And those singles landed you on NBC's Hullabaloo that was hosted by another great Canadian talent, Paul Anka.
Yeah, while he was up here, a bunch of big hits, and he was hosting the Hullabaloo show out of New York City, and they wanted a Canadian band to feature, and we just happened to have a number one hit record in Canada at the time, so Paul and his dad, Andy, called me up and asked me if we would come to New York. Here in a U-Haul trailer and my 62 Cadillac and the whole band and manager and sound man and everything, and trucked it down to New York. And that was my first hook. Wow. I ended up staying for...
So let's talk about Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
I chose you for the one. Now we're having so much fun. You know, I'm about to lose my mind. You made me very happy. I'm so glad you my life.
The group has sold, what, well over
60 million records in total over the whole career of the band.
That's fantastic. So my question is, was Judy Collins, was she pivotal in getting you to join the group?
Let's... Yeah, kind of. Well, I knew all these folks. We all hung out in Greenwich Village. We played little clubs in the village. They used to call them basket houses, where literally you go in with your guitar and stand in line with four or five other artists, who coincidentally could have been Richie Havens, James Taylor, Carole King, and then you pass the basket, and then you move down to the next club. And so we all knew each other, and I knew all the musicians. You know, the whole music industry of the world at that point was concentrated in 8 square blocks of downtown New York called Greenwich Village.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a little club gig uptown, and Bobby Colombi had a band called Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and I knew them. They played the Cafe Agogo on Bleecker Street, so I knew all the guys. And he was with Judy Collins while playing, and Bobby said, "There's my singer. That's it. I want to meet this guy. I want to talk to this guy." So Judy Collins introduced us, and the rest is history, as they say.
A rock music festival that drew hundreds of thousands of young people to a dairy farm in White Lake, New York, over the weekend came to an end today. And we have a report from Richard.
They listened for 3 days. And today they sounded the retreat and headed for home. 3 days of peace and music. It was that all right, and much more. Estimates of the crowd ranged up to more than 300,000. And it was that size that caused most of the trouble. That and the rainstorms that turned the big dairy meadow into a mud farm.
The headliners for Woodstock in 1969, what was that experience, that head of you in particular?
Confusion. We landed it the night before in Atlanta airport, and the tour manager said, "I think we're going to be at the airport for quite a while." I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, the traffic is blocked all the way from Albany to New York City. There's like 500,000 people going to this concert tonight."
Wow.
And so we actually sat in the airport 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We didn't think we were going to be able to make it. There was no way to get in there. And about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I think it was on the Saturday that we came in, the governor of New York declared the area a national disaster area because it was in an area where there was like 600,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
There was maybe 5 cops in the entire area. So, I mean, they were just terrified that if this thing got out of hand... And, of course, it was the anti-war movement, too. So there was a lot of demonstration went into it, too. And so they brought the National Guard in. They brought a helicopter over and flew us in by helicopter. So I basically landed backstage. A half an hour later, I got to hang out with the band, who were real good friends of mine from the old Young Street days, Robbie Robertson.
Yeah.
And they were all, Levon Helm, they were all backstage. They had just come off a little while ago. We had a chance to chat. We did our show, and there was the helicopter whisked us on out of there. So we weren't at Woodstock very long.
Just kind of literally flew in and flew out.
Yeah, we did. We did. Although it was pandemonium, that's for sure. But It was a remarkable event. You know, you think of five to six packed into a plowed field in the rain for 3 days, and there was not one incidence of violence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a small city. You take any city of 600,000 people, and there's no violence in 3 days?
Right. Great.
Under those conditions, it was remarkable. It movement.
Mm.
And it stopped a war. It literally stopped a war.
How long were you part of Blood, Sweat, and Tears?
Oh, 45 years or so. From 1968 when I joined, and 5 when I finally packed up and moved home to Toronto.
So why did you end up leaving the group?
Well, it was a long, long process. I had been wanting to leave for a long time, and my major reason was I'm a songwriter, and Blood, Sweat, and Tears had for 30 years, and it was a constant source of irritation between me and the band and the management, because they were making millions of dollars a year going on the road playing the oldies, so
right.
Who wants to go back in the studio again? And so I had these literally dozens of songs that I had been writing, and there was no interest within Blood, Sweat, and Tears to record.
Right.
First of all, most of the guys were just hired guns anyway. You know, they it wasn't like Blood, Sweat, and Tears, who are, most of them I'm still in touch with today, the ones who are still with us. I just saw Jim Fielder, the great bass player, just saw him a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of appears guys would leave them in, and I suddenly realized that everybody in the band was 20 years younger than me, and most of them hadn't been born at the time we started Blood, Sweat, and Tears.
Right.
And I just said, this isn't Blood, Sweat, and Tears. It's a fraud.
Right.
It isn't really it anymore.
Yeah.
Great musicians, of course. They always had tremendous musicianship, but it just was not creative anymore. There was no creative.
Right.
Well, that's what made Blood, Sweat, and Tears in the first place. It was a bunch of kind of renegade jazz musicians, mm-hmm. conservatory graduates, rock and roll yourself, all got together
mm-hmm.
and started writing music.
Well, I came across a quote of yours from, I guess, back in the day, talking about your 1969 number 2 smash hit on Billboard, Spinning Wheel, and that by the likes of Peggy Lee, Benny Goodman, James Brown, Shirley Bassey. And
my social media gal said, let's do some archives for, I said, okay. So she said, let's go and take a look at Spinning Wheel. We found over 400 versions of Spinning Wheel. 400 different artists had recorded it.
Yeah.
We said,
so
I think we can do away with Ray Conniff singers and a few of those. But yeah, Peggy Lee, Sammy Davis
yeah.
Jr.
Fantastic.
And some people I didn't even know had recorded it. James.
Apparently an instrumental version. Who knew?
Yeah, exactly.
Simply this. Don't get too caught up because everything comes full circle. My last question for you, Mr. David Clayton Thomas. Spinning Wheel.
I don't know what inspires some songs. It's just an idea, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, the hardest thing about writing a song, I mean, some writers just go and gush out all of their inner thoughts and their pain, and nobody understands me, and what a world, what a terrible world it is, and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But I think really good songwriters tell a story.
Yeah.
And I think of Dylan, and I think of the band.
Mm-hmm.
They were some of them, and Paul Simon. Every song is like a little three-act play. It's got characters and a plot something.
Yeah.
And I think Spinning Wheel was just saying exactly what it says, you know, because everything's going to change.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's going to come around full circle. And sure enough, it went from Woodstock to Trump. Now it comes pretty much full circle, doesn't it? But everything goes round. There's nothing permanent. But when you're young, as we all were when we were in our early 20s, you're going to live forever, you know, and everything is forever. Well, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
And as you grow older, you begin to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a line in the song that says, we thought that we were never growing old.
Mm-hmm.
We thought peace would last forever, and we thought that we were never growing old. And I think that's part of the philosophy of Spinning Wheel, too, is, you know, that this wasn't going to last.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't.
David Clayton Thomas, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for your time, Mark. I appreciate it.
What goes up must come down. Spinning wheel got to go round. Talking about in sin, let the spinning wheel spin. You got no money and you spinning wheel all alone. Talking about your troubles and you never learn. Right spinning wheel turn. Did you find the directing sign on the straight and narrow highway? Would you mind the reflecting sign? Just let it shine within your mind and show. Painted pony on the spinning wheel ride.
Musician and singer-songwriter David Clayton Thomas, who passed away at 84 on June 24th, 2026.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Reality TV. Rocco, hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you? I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you are more than welcome. You are more than welcome. I am well. I'm even better now that I have you on to talk about all things you. Okay, you are a dancer. You are an actor, a Broadway performer, a reality TV personality. You're also a husband. But let's start here. The performing arts. Let's go back to the beginning. How did you originally fall in love with the performing arts? Whether that was dancing, singing, acting. How did you originally?
So when I was younger, I always had tricks. But I didn't really have any examples of any performers in my life. I mostly found in school, in after school programs, in during school programs. I was in the drama class in school, and my teachers that encouraged me to continue down that road. And that gave me as a career, which was amazing. So my teachers kind of changed my life. It's amazing.
Was that during your time attending a high school for the
performance? You know, it started actually when I was in junior high school, I would say. I had this teacher named Miss Stein, and she really believed in me, and she helped me prepare for the audition for High School Performing Arts. I wound up auditioning, getting in. I attended there for 4 years of high school, commuted from up at 5 a.m. every single day, take a 2-hour commute into Manhattan, go to school. And our school day was very long. It was from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., get home at 6 p.m. and go right to dance school. And I would dance until sometimes 11 at night, go home later and do it all over again. So during high school, I was training for sure with no like ultimate not to perform for a living. I was just loving it. I was just having a good time. And then my teachers at LaGuardia, they were the ones that really gave me the courage to perform for a living. It was great. Very grateful.
At what point did you make the decision to start putting yourself out there, to start auditioning for things like musicals? At what point did you start putting yourself out there then? If when you were in school, you weren't necessarily thinking that you would end up doing that.
Senior year of high school, I was in the show City of Angels. And when I did that show, I got bit by the bug. I had a really fun part. So I was like, you know, getting all the laughs from the audience. And for me, it's always been about the relationship between an audience and a performer to that electricity, that connection. So when I did that show and I felt that energy, it kind of changed my whole life. That's when I started to pivot and think, maybe I could, with my teachers believing in me and pushing me, is what I needed. But up until then, it was just recreational. I just loved it. I had a good time, but I thought I was going to be an architect. That's what I thought I was going to do. And then started auditioning and I was booking. I wound up leaving. I went to one semester of college. I went to Marymount Manhattan College. I have so many fun stories. So I go on tangents sometimes, but this is another fun story. I auditioned for Marymount Manhattan College, their theater. I still went to their school though, for like just general ed credits. And I was auditioning simultaneously while I was in my first semester. I wound up booking work and I left school to go do Guys and Dolls in Arizona. It was a random, and I fell in love with it. I wound up continuing well. I went back and auditioned again for Marymount College program, the theater program year, but I didn't go. I said, no, I just wanted to prove to them that they made a mistake the first time around. But then once I got in, I said, no, sayonara, sorry. And I continued to audition, book work. And then shortly after, I made my Broadway debut doing Newsies. So it really all worked out, but a testament to who I am. I'm like, I'm very much, oh, you don't, and then I don't want you anyway. Like, that's who I am. So I just think that's like a fun story that encompasses who I am.
Don't cross the Bronco.
That's okay. Right. That's right.
So the real life Newsboys strike of 1899 in New York City, 2011. This was was being on Newsies.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
And so what was that experience like being on Broadway, not necessarily Broadway at some point, but ending up being on Broadway? What was that experience like for you, generally speaking?
It was a dream come true. Like, if as a performer, you have all these dreams, every performer pretty much has things that they want to accomplish. It's perform on the Thanksgiving Day parade, perform at the Tony, be on an original cast album. With news of those boxes. So like, truly, this experience made every dream come true. We felt like rock stars. Every single night we would come out of the stage, there would be hundreds for us. This was at the time when Instagram had just come out. Things were changing. Social media was becoming a mainstream part of Broadway. And we were front for this, I would say, it's a moment that day, a major part of Broadway and the industry. And we were there at the at the turn of it. So it felt very cool, very humbling. I think when you're in it, it's easy to become a little numb. I was also very young. Like I said, I'm from Staten Island, so I was commuting 2 hours there and back every single night. After the show, I would run out of the stage door, run to the train, take the ferry, and commute 2 hours home. I wouldn't even really do the stage, go back and do that stage door, because it would be so fun to connect with those people. But at the time, I was kind of just like numb to it all. You don't really appreciate it till it's gone, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But it was incredible. It was.
So we have 2011, Pretty Woman, the musical.
Yep.
Talk to me about being a Broadway performer and the discipline that it takes and how challenging it be. For yourself, how was that? Like, how disciplined did you have to be? And you just gave us an example, like you have to run out the door and get home, essentially, to get, you know, to be able to make it home. How disciplined did you have to be while you were on Broadway?
Well, funny enough, when I was doing Newsies, we were so young, we didn't even really have to warm up. That was the crazy part. Actually, I can only speak for myself. A lot of people would do the right thing and warm their bodies up, but I wouldn't. I would literally just show up, do a bunch of back handsprings before the show. But the funny part is, and Newsies had some of the most, I think, that has to this. And I would do, it was totally good, golden. My body was used to it. The muscle memory was amazing. I would go to a dance class, and we would dance nowhere near as difficult as what we were doing in Newsies. And I wouldn't be able to move the next day. Like, muscle memory is such a thing. And I definitely rely. When I went, but this is the thing, sorry, the initial tangent again. The initial question was, what do I do to like upkeep when, you know, to be on Broadway? How do you, you know, be disciplined? The truth is, when you book a Broadway show, that's when you're actually on vacation. The job is staying when the audition does come up that you can book the show. Auditioning is the job, not one. So right now, like, well, also the end, I used to have like, you know, 5 auditions a week if I wanted. Now I'll get 5 every 6 months. Like, it's very different. So industry is changing, partially because I'm getting older, but it's interesting to see her as time has gone on, for sure. Newsies, Pretty Woman, and The Heart of Rock and Roll. Newsies was 2011, 2012, around there it came out, and it went till like 2014. Pretty Woman was 2018 to 2019. And then Heart of Rock and Roll was 2024. So you can see there's a lot of gaps in there. There's a lot of times when you're not working as a Broadway performer, and you have to, you're not performing. Otherwise, you will be miserable, because a lot of being a Broadway performer is not working. That's just the harsh reality of it. So you have to love your life, even when you're not on stage. And when you're on stage, yeah. Anyway, another tangent. I apologize.
There's a show, Titanic.
I did Titanic off Broadway, and I had the best time. It was so great. Amazing show, amazing creative team. I really risked and did something different. And I was so, yes, I did the show off Broadway. That happened immediately after The Heart of Rock and Roll, 5-ish. Yeah.
And on that note, we'll return after this Rainbow Country update.
C CFRC announced the launch of our brand new accessible website at cfrc.ca. Get your local news, stream your favorite shows, and stay up to date with upcoming events. You can share news tips, book a recording studio, request a PSA for airplay, and oh so much more. CFRC.ca was made possible through the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada and our amazing funding drive donors. Thank you so much.
After 9 long months, Gale's Game Day makes its triumphant return to CFRC.
Queens Gales are golden once more.
Tune in on Sunday, August 30th at 6:45 p.m. to catch all the action that makes you stand up and say... This is Canada's most exhilarating sports broadcast.
And it's picked off, picked off, picked off.
This is Canada's gold standard of...
Stop the Griffiths short.
This...
Hard breaking away. Touchdown, Queens.
And it can only be found on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Hi, I'm Agnes. My new record, Magic Still Exists, is out now with Mark Tara.
This is gay hip-hop artist, the Mangfather Bob Katz. An artist friend of mine recommended that I check out Mark Tara's Rainbow Country years ago, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Mark's excellent interviews highlight all aspects of the LGBTQ community, and he's not afraid to ask the difficult questions that other hosts avoid. And I love, love, love the music that Mark plays on Rainbow Country each week, especially when he plays my music. But seriously, Mark Tara has been such a supporter of my music and has turned me on to so many great LGBTQ artists that I'd never heard of before. I'm so grateful to Mark Tara's Rainbow Country.
Hey, I'm Connor, founder and director of Load Count Studios. If you're an adult Connor or Triple X entrepreneur, I want to invite you to CreatorCon Canada. It's a free 3-day event happening right here in Toronto, Friday, August 28th through Sunday, August 30th. Learn from industry professionals, discover new opportunities, and grow your business in a welcoming community. For more information, creatorconcanada.com. See you there.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing, based on a person's sexual orientation, was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive Conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. 4 PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
I'm Billy Newton Davis, and we're sitting here on the fabulous Mark Tara.
Talking about you, we're talking about you as a performer, specifically as a Broadway performer. You're also a reality TV personality. You've been on shows like The Challenge, season 21, reality TV, Broadway. Broadway, reality TV. Do you have a preference?
I don't have a preference. What I like to say is Broadway tests what you can do and reality TV tests who you are. And the bottom line is I like to be tested. I like to be challenged. I like having to rise to the occasion. So equally, I think the interesting part is that growing up in this industry when I was younger, there was a stigma with reality TV. And I think that I was led to believe that you couldn't do both. Kind of feel like I proved that stigma to be wrong. And I don't know if it's just, I think that something like, it's on TV, you come off with followers on social media, and followers and social media matters more in the Broadway space than it did more than ever. So I learned that now, instead of there being a stigma, they can actually fuel each other, which is my perfect scenario, because I really love both Broadway and reality TV.
Well, let's talk about Yurtifically, because mm-hmm. I love the show. I think you love the show. A lot of people love the show. Big Brother is a show like Brother Canada, was on for, I believe, like 12 seasons. It's coming back. Big Brother US has been running since 2000. And I think what makes this show end up above the rest is the fact that it's in real time. You have 24-hour live feeds that you can actually see how the show live feed, the episodes are created. And it runs, basically like 3 months, that sort of thing. You were on Big Brother 21, I believe in 2019. Well done to you.
Thanks.
Again, a general question. How was your experience, generally speaking, on Big Brother 21?
I loved Big Brother. Like, it was a dream. When I first watched the show, I felt like I was meant to be on it. I really did. I just got a weird feeling, and I knew that I was, like, it was for me. I felt it. Dreams as a super fan. You want to get a punishment. You want to win HOH. You want to iconic comps. I got to check every bucket list item off. I really did, except for winning. That's it. So when I was there, it was a dream come true, truly. And I still look back on it, and I'm so grateful for the experience. What I did not expect was to come off of the show and be faced with as much adversity. At the time, it was very overwhelming, but now I look back on that time and I'm so grateful for it, because it really made me grow as a person. And that's something that, like, for the rest of my life. So Big Brother changed me, and that's something, maybe I didn't win me for forever.
Adversity in what regard?
There was so much. I mean, you know, Big Brother, there's always controversy with Big Brother. So obviously my season, that's what I'm referencing. Mm.
Okay, so let's talk about being gay on reality TV. You recently put out a post on your socials, essentially talking about and how there have not been any, say, gay masterminds when it comes to the show. Although I will say, Andy Heron, who won his season openly gay, trained as a mastermind on the episodes, but you would realize that if you watch the live feeds, which is basically how the show is made, you would see him doing certain things and, you know, being a bit of a rat or not, or however you viewed him.
Yep.
Talk to me about what you were getting at.
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head. The edits don't show a gay person. Andy comes very close. We're talking edit-wise, the episodes. That's what I'm referencing. If you watch the live feeds, you know the truth. You know that Andy was a mastermind. He was a genius player. He maneuvered his way.
But he doesn't have that reputation, which is interesting.
He doesn't. And I don't think it's a coincidence. No gay person has that reputation, but a lot of straight white men do. And I don't think that's a coincidence either. I think that there's an issue with representation within the editing of these reality TV shows. And I've thought this for a while, but I'm finally this is a conversation that I feel very passionate about. I just think that incidents that all of our masterminds are not gay men. It just can't be. We know that there have been mastermind gay men players, or not even just gay men, gay people on the show. There have been really great trade that way. That's the bottom line. A lot of times, per season, a lot of times, again, gay. They're the funny one. They're the dramatic one.
Exactly. And so let me... They're the comedian. Exactly. That's what I was going to say to you. Do you think that... Because this is on CBS, specifically mm-hmm. Big Brother, and it's on Broadway, you know, one of the major networks in the U.S., mm-hmm. CBS, a broadcast network. Mm-hmm. And when they do cast a gay person... A lot of times, though, to be, and I don't necessarily want to use this term, but they tend to be the funny mm-hmm. one. They tend to be, mm-hmm. you know, the life of the party I'm generalizing, but for the most part, but they're not sexual beings. You know, there's that, I think it's a biblical mm-hmm. saying, love the sinner, hate the sin. Right? Mm. It's like, love the sinner, hate the sin. You can be gay, essentially. Mm-hmm. And on reality TV, like a Big Brother, we rarely see gay men flirting with each other or a gay person, you know, openly in a showmance with another woman, with a woman. It rarely happens. And so why do you think that is? That it rarely happens on reality TV. And in this case, we're talking about Big Brother.
I think that it's very nuanced, this conversation, because I think the main people from Middle America, and they may not be ready they may not be as accepting. The truth of the matter is I'm from New York City, so everyone in my world is very accepting. But that's not the world that we live in necessarily. And that's not who watches Big Brother. A lot of times you go to these big cities, LA, New York, Chicago.
They're bubbles.
They're bubbles. And I don't meet Big Brother fans there. But if I go to, when I go to Disney World, the amount of Big Brother fans that I meet, and that's because people from all over the country travel to Disney World. That's who's watching Big Brother. So the network has to cater to their audience because that's how they make money through advertising. So while this is like that, with all this said, I don't think it's any one entity's fault for this issue. I think it's an issue that exists. But I think that like the network has advertisers that they have to cater to, also trying to move the needle in terms of society and acceptance. And in season 23 was the first time that we had a black winner. That's not a coincidence. That's because black people weren't set up for success.
And there were a number of cast members that were, you know, that were part of that community cast specifically to see if this would happen.
And it did. It's all very nuanced. It is, because I don't know what it's like to be in those board meetings, the money of it all, the advertisers, the high profile conversations that these networks are having. I don't understand to get that, but I do know what it's like to be a gay man on these shows and be, funny you say that, because that's exactly what I call it too. I feel like a court gem, and changes, because there's so much more to gay people than just being the funny sidekick. Like,
I don't think the show RuPaul's Drag Race, while it's a great platform for, you know, drag performers, I don't necessarily know if that helps move the needle either, because I think a lot of people are seeing, you know, members of the LGBT community, gay men, in that certain light, you know, as drag queens, you know, that sort of thing. And I don't, as opposed to people that are sexual beings, we're not seeing that necessarily. Unless you're talking about a movie or, you know, a TV show, that sort of thing. But Do you see things changing? Do you see reality TV evolving to be more, I don't want to say inclusive, because currently, but being more that queer people can be, you know, the masterminds and maybe even win some of these shows?
I hope so. That is my goal with putting out a video like I did. My goal is to try and move the needle, to at least get people thinking. Because I look back, I went 79 days without ever hitting the block. I won 3 different competitions. I did really well. And I played a great game. And I'm very proud of the game that I played. But if you watch the season, backstab. But in reality, there was so much more to it. Like, mastermind by any means. If I was a mastermind, I would have won. But I played a great game. And that one, I just think that that's interesting. So maybe this is all fueled by self, by self-experience. I hope that the world rise and have these conversations more. It's tough. Like, when you watch a show like Big Brother, you are looking for representation to find yourself in that house. And so if majority of the people that are watching are from, then it's, I get why the network would want to give representation
more
that
of themselves.
They could, more of themselves. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's the answer, because that's how we make things change, by challenging people, by making them maybe even uncomfortable.
Exposure.
100%. But I do think that that's the reality of reality, no pun intended. I think that's what's been going on since the beginning of reality TV. And I hope that it changes. I really do. Yeah.
Tommy, before I let you go, who is Joseph Mackley?
My husband. Yeah, he's the best. I love him.
How did you guys meet?
We met on Hinge. He's amazing. You know, I'm crazy. I'm outgoing. I'm wild. And he is the calm to my storm. He's the cross his T's, dot his I's kind of guy, where I am just a scribble scrabble. And it works. We bring out the best in each other. And I'm very grateful for that. We got married last year. We got married a little over a year ago.
2025.
We're looking to have a family now. So we're working on that. And I'm very lucky. Very lucky.
Well, Tommy Bracco, I have to say, well said, well done, well reality TV'd and Broadway'd.
Thanks
for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That was my spotlight on Broadway performer and reality TV personality, Tommy Bracco, who you can find each week as a co-host on the Outhouse podcast, a podcast that's part of the Heavy Crown Network on YouTube.
Magnus Hirschfeld made the modern homosexual. He co-founded the world's first gay rights group, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, in Berlin in 1897. But what is far more important is that he and his colleagues came up with an enormously influential concept of what same-sex is and how it fit into the wider world. If you think homosexuality is an inborn quality that cannot be changed and has a biological root, but is not an illness, and if you think gay people are a sexual minority who are born that way and who deserve legal protection, you owe those ideas to Hirschfeld and a handful of others. He was among the first to articulate that conceptual model of what it means to be gay in print in 1896.
We just heard professor, author, and historian of queer and trans politics, Lori Marhoefer, reading from Racism and the Making of Gay Rights, a sexologist, his student, and the Empire of Queer Love, their powerful new gay history book, about the man who made the modern homosexual, a German physician and sexologist who died at the age of 1735, Magnus Hirschfeld.
Phone rings. I got a message back the next day. I get the call and he said, if you'd accept, honor you with the key to the city. There was an event later that key, right? Like, key to what? A decent job, a good singing career. It's really a metaphor, but talked to me and says, you know, well, so it's key, right? Like, what's the big deal? Just, well, so I looked it up, and I guess it is kind of a big deal.
The date, May 17th, 2018, when trans activist Susan Gapka made history by becoming the first trans woman to be presented with the key to the city of Toronto. By the way, past recipients include Rush and the Raptors.
Hi, I'm Justin Ling, author of Missing from the Village. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country. From the original Broadway cast recording of Newsies, Brooklyn's Here.